You are listening to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. Welcome, everyone. Today, Dr. Blevins talks about a couple of recent cases of disorders of ACTH. Here's Dr. Blevins.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Louis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting from San Francisco, California, on an absolutely spectacular, lovely Indian summer afternoon here in early October in Northern California. I'd like to talk to you today about a couple of patients that presented with disorders of ACTH recently. Actually, yesterday. But first, let's talk about ACTH and some of the scenarios where it's a problem. ACTH stands for adrenocorticotrophic hormone, and it's produced by the ACTH-producing cells known as corticotroph cells of the anterior pituitary gland. Its job is to lead to cortisol production by the adrenal glands, and it in turn, the pituitary and the hypothalamus measure how much cortisol or other steroid is in the circulation and then can downregulate ACTH production. ACTH is stimulated by CRH, or corticotropin-releasing hormone, made by the hypothalamus, and arginine vasopressin, also made by cells in the hypothalamus, can travel to the anterior pituitary and lead to ACTH release. Now, the stress response involves endotoxin, autonomic nervous system, and other factors that can also lead to ACTH release. This whole pathway is also regulated by the endorphinergic system, such that high levels of opiates can suppress ACTH release, for example. ACTH comes from a larger molecule known as POMC, or pro-opiomelanocortin, and this is a big molecule that's actually carved up into several different fragments, leading to production of beta endorphins and melanocyte-stimulating hormone and a whole bunch of other peptides as well that are also secreted into the circulation. This is one of the reasons that some patients with ACTH elevations may notice some hyperpigmentation, because they're also having melanocyte-stimulating hormone released. Some, however, believe that ACTH itself can bind to the melanocyte-stimulating hormone receptor and lead to hyperpigmentation. At any rate, it's a pretty complex system. And there are a number of disease processes that can affect ACTH secretion by the pituitary gland, either directly or indirectly. I like to think of these as disorders of ACTH deficiency and disorders of ACTH excess. First, the excess. The most common thing we probably see related to ACTH excess is Cushing syndrome. And recall that ACTH-producing pituitary tumors, whether they be microadenomas or macroadenomas, can lead to Cushing syndrome. Also, however, ectopic-producing tumors located in the lung, pancreas, thyroid gland, and a number of other places can also result in ACTH elevations and lead to Cushing syndrome. One thing that people often forget about is the fact that patients who have primary adrenal insufficiency, either due to surgery or due to Addison's disease or adrenal hemorrhage or any other number of disease states that lead to adrenal insufficiency, will also have an elevated ACTH level. And we'll talk more about that a little later. When it comes to ACTH deficient states, probably the most important one is hypopituitarism for whatever reason that leads to destruction of the ACTH-producing cells and leads to the need to take hydrocortisone supplementation. It's important to remember that some people with adrenal tumors that secrete cortisol or patients who have exogenous steroids may also have ACTH deficiency. But look, Cushingoid and be suspected originally of having ACTH excess. So that's pretty much the major pathophysiological classifications. And let me just talk briefly about a couple of patients, because I think there's some learning points based on my experiences with these two patients and their experiences with prior physicians. The first one was a patient who had a history of a Rathke's cleft cyst and had undergone surgery that was successful and postoperatively had normal pituitary gland functions. He returned for annual follow-up and had an MRI that showed his pituitary cyst had not recurred. He also had laboratory studies that were obtained that illustrated ACTH level was low and his cortisol level was essentially nearly undetectable, and all other pituitary functions were normal. So this is a patient who has newly established ACTH and cortisol deficiency, and he felt terrible. He had fatigue, diminished energy, maybe a little bit of a loss of appetite, but really had an overall poor sense of well-being. And the first inclination would believe that he had adrenal insufficiency of a pituitary nature. His pituitary gland looked fine. So the first question you ask a patient like this is, have you been exposed to any exogenous steroids that might have suppressed ACTH and then cortisol levels? Now, he did not look Cushingoid, and many people who had been treated with steroids would come to the office looking Cushingoid and have low cortisol levels, and it's a little bit more obvious. But with this patient, you had to actually ask the question because he had no Cushingoid features whatsoever. Lo and behold, he had received very high doses of dexamethasone, enough for 80 people injected into his spine, and then he had another long-acting steroid injected subsequent to that. And prior to the steroid injections, he had been on a prolonged course of oral steroids. And this patient, who's seeing me months after that steroid therapy, really didn't have any steroid side effects of the medications, except his pituitary adrenal function was suppressed, and he had symptoms of adrenal insufficiency as a consequence of the ACTH suppression due to the high doses of steroids. So the obvious thing to do for a patient like this is to treat them with a low dose of steroids to improve their overall symptoms and signs. In any patient who has chronic pain or back problems, you also have to wonder whether they are taking narcotic medications, which may also suppress ACTH and subsequently cortisol secretion and lead to central adrenal insufficiency as a result of chronic and high dose narcotic therapy. This patient was not on any narcotics, so that was not a problem in this particular situation, but it's something that we see fairly regularly, so it needs to be considered by physicians and patients alike that could be a problem. So it's a relatively straightforward case to me, but no one had solved this man's problem as to why he was feeling so poorly until he came to the office and I took a look at things. Now, the other patient is a woman who had a little bit of weight gain, some hyperpigmentation, and she had extreme fatigue. And during a course of evaluation for possible Cushing syndrome, they found that her urine cortisol levels were low normal. She had a normal dexamethasone suppression test. I believe her salivary cortisol level was also normal, but I'm not entirely sure about that. But her ACTH levels were in the 70s, normals up to about 55 in the assay that was used. And she basically came to me with the question of, does this patient have Cushing's? Why is her ACTH level elevated? And, you know, those of you who have had Cushing's or know someone who has had Cushing's would feel like, okay, ACTH is high, let's think about the pituitary, let's think about whether there really is Cushing's or a tumor somewhere. And I know many of you might even advocate doing all sorts of tests to see whether she had cyclical Cushing syndrome or whatever. But the point is, you have to stay grounded in what's going on with the patient. And this is a woman who had Hashimoto thyroiditis and primary hypothyroidism. It was taking thyroid hormone as a consequence. And interestingly, she had a mother who also had hypothyroidism, and a grandmother had hypothyroidism, and somebody else had another autoimmune disorder. So my thinking is that this patient might have early subclinical adrenal failure or primary adrenal insufficiency. And this is a well-known phenomenon where people have polyglandular autoimmune syndrome or autoimmune failure. And the most common association is Hashimoto thyroiditis and primary adrenal insufficiency. About 50% of those patients also have type 1 diabetes mellitus. Some have other autoimmune disorders such as lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or vitiligo or premature graying of the hair or some form of a dermatitis, for example. But it's an autoimmune disorder and it's inherited genetic phenotype. What we do know is that patients who have early primary adrenal failure And this not only comes from studies of patients who have true Addison's disease, but also patients who have adrenomyeloneuropathy, where they get adrenal failure. Patients who have early disease have elevated ACTH levels, and that elevated ACTH overdrives the adrenal glands to make normal levels of cortisol. So it's sort of a compensatory response to the early stages of adrenal failure. One of the other things that happens is that these patients have elevated plasma renin levels to maintain adrenal aldosterone production. And it's not until the later stages of the disease, sometimes 15, 20 years later, that patients actually have the full-blown syndrome of adrenal insufficiency. So my thinking on this particular patient is to, given that the urine cortisol level was in the low part of the normal range and the dexamethasone suppression test was normal, to abandon the thought of a diagnosis of possible Cushing syndrome and to proceed evaluating for evidence of subclinical adrenal failure in this patient who may have polyglandular autoimmune syndrome. So we're in the process of evaluating her at this time with appropriate studies and adrenal antibodies, etc. And I look forward to seeing those results. But I'm fairly convinced she does not have Cushing syndrome. These two patients, I think, are examples of how one must understand the nuances and complexities and caveats of disease processes to be able to distinguish one from another. Oftentimes, the history tells the story, looking at the past medical history, the family history, talking to the patient, and both remind me of the old adage that if you let them, the patient will tell you what's wrong with them. Not always, but the point to be taken is that there are clues that often lead to the underlying diagnosis, especially if one can get out of the mindset of thinking, oh, this is probably Cushing's, so let's work it up until we're frustrated we can't prove that it's Cushing's. So one must be able to have entertained the possibility of everything that fits into the pathophysiological disease state. And ACTH disorders are a classic example of that, where you can have deficiency or excess, and in the case of ACTH deficiency, for example, it could be due to excess cortisol production from the adrenal gland, or lead to deficient cortisol production from the adrenal gland. And in a setting of ACTH excess, it could be leading to excess cortisol production from the adrenal gland, or it could be a prelude to deficient cortisol production by the adrenal gland. And that is relatively straightforward and simple to me, but it seems to be very complex to most other physicians and many patients alike. And the point is, sometimes it takes an expert with many years of experience to try to sort through these things. And everything is usually, in the end, true, and related, but sometimes things aren't very obvious until the dust settles. And it requires an open mind and understanding of pathophysiology and disease classifications and what can be and what might be when you're evaluating patients with certain types of complaints. At any rate, I hope you learned a little bit about ACTH and some of the disorders and how you can see excess or deficiency and have either cortisol excess or deficiency with both the excess and the deficiency. So it's kind of a fun play on words. Hopefully awareness of this will keep your mind open to this and other similar possibilities throughout the realm of pituitary disease and endocrinology. Once again, this has been Dr. Lewis Blevins podcasting from San Francisco, California. As always, please give us your feedback and let us know if you're interested in any particular topics, and we'll either write an article or do a podcast to empower you to understand more about your pituitary diseases. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Blevins. That was a very informative podcast indeed. I also want to thank our supporters and listeners for their generous contributions. Thanks in part for those contributions, we've been able to continue to publish articles, record podcasts, and continually research to find valuable information. We have a long list of exciting initiatives we'd like to implement, initiatives we know will make a difference to our effort. Pituitary World News, as you know, is totally free of charge and is supported by donations and contributions from people like you and companies that, just like you, believe in our mission to increase awareness, improve quality of life, and reduce the number of undiagnosed and misdiagnosed people with debilitating disease. So if you'd like to donate, any amount works really, and it will be truly appreciated. Simply go to pituitaryworldnews.org to get to our donations page and click on Get Involved at the top of the page. Thank you so much, and as always, your donation is fully tax deductible. Thank you for listening.